Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Market Volatility Conference Call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mike Evans, Vice President, National Sales Initiatives. Please go ahead, Mr. Evans.
Thanks, Emily, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Market Volatility Conference Call number 12. And it's the final call in our 12-week series. As you know, our goal has been to help you stay connected in these incredibly challenging times. We understood at the outbreak of the COVID crisis the importance of firsthand access to timely information on market developments, and we recognize how challenging staying connected in these times has been. So each week we've committed to bringing you relevant commentary during these calls from both a macroeconomic and portfolio management perspective. And today, on our final call, it's no different. Today, you'll hear from three senior members of Mackenzie's investment team. Joining us are Todd Mattina, certainly backed by popular demand. We've had Todd on many of these calls. He's a senior vice president and co-team lead of the multi-asset strategies team, member of the Global Investment Committee, and chief economist at Mackenzie Investments. Todd has an impressive resume with time spent at CPPIB, managing currencies, 10 years with the IMF, working to stabilize developing nations around the world, and most recently time spent with the Investment Management Corporation of Ontario. So he's going to provide us with a macroeconomic perspective of the evolving crisis. Now, also with us on today's call and backed by popular demand are Benoit Gervais, Senior Vice President, Investment Management, and Head of Mackenzie's Resource Team, along with Ono Rutten, Vice President, Investment Management, and Co-Portfolio Manager on Mackenzie's Resource Team. Now, a team widely regarded as one of the top resource management teams in the country. Now, they run the Mackenzie Global Resource Fund and Class, the Mackenzie Gold Bullion Class, and Mackenzie's Precious Metals Class Funds. Now, while Ono and Benoit intend to provide a brief overview of the complete commodity complex, including oil and gas, along with their opinions, we're going to add gold and the role gold can play as a long-term inflation hedge and diversifying influence in client portfolios. Benoit and Ono recently authored an industry white paper garnering some attention entitled More Money is Coming Your Way, and one whose primary thesis is building a case for gold in your client portfolios. Now, a couple of comments on today's call. The call is being recorded, and a playback number along with a play summary, a call summary, will be made available to you by your sales team after the call. After the formal presentation, we will also have a moderated Q&A to allow you to ask whatever's on your mind of both Todd, Benoit, and Ono. And any questions we don't get to, we'd ask you to direct back to your Mackenzie sales teams. We'll try and get you a timely response. So, gentlemen, welcome back. All of you have been on the call before. Certainly a lot to talk about today. So, Todd, let's begin with you. It seems every day brings a slightly new perspective and, once again, new surprises. Who would have anticipated the events of the last week, racial and social unrest, taking the world's attention away from the pandemic? The world seems to be in a delicate balance right now, dealing with the additional challenges along with COVID. So as chief economist, we've often heard from you speaking of evaluating the risks and opportunities facing us in the investment landscape. What are your thoughts on the way things are unfolding with both the crisis and recent events in the U.S.?
Well, thanks, Mike. And first, let me say it's a pleasure to be part of the call again, and welcome everyone who's listening. Hope you're all doing well. Yeah, as you say, the social protests that we're seeing play out in the U.S. right now are really tragic and devastating. And I think as a first line of defense, the first defense, we can look at sort of historical results or historical market performance following these kinds of social protests. And markets have a history of looking past social and political upheavals. If we look back in history, U.S. stocks were up in 1968 after the riots following Martin Luther King assassination. They were also up in 1992 after the Rodney King protests. So markets seem to be more focused on the macroeconomic fundamentals, and then currently the focus seems to be squarely on the reopening of economies after the lockdown and the V-shaped economic bounce that many market participants are currently pricing into markets. Now, with that said, I think there's important scenarios that we have to consider in the context of these social protests. If we were to see a scenario play out, one that's not currently, I would say, priced in markets and one that's not sort of the consensus view, but if we were to see a period of prolonged unemployment with unemployment rates in the U.S. remaining well over 10% as the slowdown resulting from the lockdown becomes more of an L shape, more of a dragged out, slow recovery from the sharp recession, we may see more of these types of protests play out over time as some of the most vulnerable social groups in the U.S. have been disproportionately affected by COVID and now also by unemployment and income losses. So when you have additional sparks involving, the tragic deaths that we saw on video, I think that sort of sets the stage for these kinds of violent protests. So I think looking ahead, it would not be surprising to me to see governments, different state level and federal government in the U.S., try to maintain the high level of income support and social support through budgetary policies and expanding budget deficits to try to get unemployment rates back down to pre-pandemic levels. Maybe with that, I'll switch gears and focus a little bit on the economic outlook at this point and its implications for financial markets more generally, including, in particular, the global stock market. Now, as we all know, Canadian and U.S. stock markets rallied by almost over 35% since the low point on March 23rd. And other risk assets are also performing well, such as U.S. high-yield bonds, which have gained significantly as spreads dropped by more than 4 percentage points from the low point. Now, before thinking about what's next for markets and global stocks in particular, I think it's important to step back and understand the drivers of these recent sharp gains. And after all, the market's optimism at this stage seems divorced from the severe state of the global economy, with almost 40 million Americans filing for unemployment claims and 3 million Canadians unemployed in March and April alone. And in my mind, the investor's current optimism really reflects two factors. The first is that if we look at surveys of economic forecasts, they point to an expected V-shaped recession in 2020 and rebound in 2021, largely on the back of aggressive economic policies, both in terms of enormous scale of those policies and the rapid implementation to prop up the global economy. These forecasting surveys also show that by next year, corporate earnings for the S&P 500 and TSX companies are expected to surpass 2019 levels, completing the rebound to pre-pandemic levels. The second factor, I think, underlying the market's optimism is that many investors are expecting central banks to continue propping up financial markets with lower for longer interest rates. And to understand why low interest rates are so important for equity fair values, I think we have to first consider what are the impact of these lower for longer rates on government bonds. The yield on the 30-year U.S. Treasury, for example, has dropped by over 100 basis points from 2.4% on January 1st to about 1.4% last week. And that led to gains in the 30-year bond by about 26%. Now, just like long-term bonds, stock markets provide investors with a long-term stream of cash flows, dividends rather than coupons. So it's natural that equity markets should also gain when long-term interest rates fall. And from first principles, we all know that the fair value for stock markets is simply the discounted value of future earnings. And in fact, that implies that even small changes in interest rates sustained over a long period of time can increase the theoretical fair value of the stock market quite sharply. Small moves sustained over time by 25 to 50 basis points can jump the theoretical fair value of the stock market by 15 to 30%. So given an expected gradual recovery in corporate earnings and lower for longer interest rates, the rebound in stock markets since March 23rd can really be understood as a reversion back towards long-term fair values. Now, the trillion-dollar question is what's next for the global stock market? My team, the multi-asset strategy team's outlook for global markets, is based on three types of insights that we believe are really important for understanding or forecasting future returns. These are asset valuations, investor sentiment, and expected economic conditions. So let me just walk through those three themes. Now, in terms of valuation, we don't currently see the U.S. or Canadian stock market as significantly out of line at its current prices relative to the long-term fundamentals. We think about stock market fair values in two ways. The first is valuations relative to government bonds, and the second is stock market valuations relative to their own history. Now, stock markets do appear somewhat attractive today versus government bonds, which are offering near record low yields. But stocks do look richly valued compared to their own histories based on standard type of measures like the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio. Overall, we don't think equity market valuations stand out as largely misvalued given today's low bond yields. And since valuations don't provide us with strong insights about the next move in stocks either way, our team also looks at short and medium-term factors to help forecast the market. Investor sentiment is an example of a short-term factor we look at, and the behavioral biases of investors, such as over and underreaction to news, and especially recently, the fear of missing out, helps us time entry and exit into stock markets. Now, the persistently high market volatility and narrow breadth of stocks participating in the overall market's recent gains have really held back investors' enthusiasm for this rally. It's been an unloved rally in many ways. And we can see that narrow breadth at the S&P sector level. Energy is still sharply down, financials down, industrials down. And it's really strong gains in growth-sensitive sectors like information technology that are actually positive on the year. So from this basis, both long-term fundamental valuations and short-term investor sentiment aren't really providing us with compelling factors to position over or underweight in equities. So that's shifting our focus to the remaining factor, which we believe drives expected returns, and that's expected economic conditions over the next 6 to 18 months. So surveys of economists' forecasts are a useful proxy of what investors may have priced in. As their economic assumptions about future growth, they currently indicate a V-shaped bounce in GDP during late 2020 to 2021 with a stabilization in 2022. Now, this would broadly match the pattern of most post-war economic recoveries, like we saw, for example, in 1979 to 82. At the other extreme, we see recoveries that tend to be slower, particularly following financial crises. And these typically result from a steady buildup of imbalances, such as excessive debt relative to income. And that can lead to a severe recession and very slow recovery, because it takes time to deleverage, for example, as we saw after the 2007-9 global financial crisis. Now, in today's great lockdown of 2020, there were no real prior imbalances that were building up that led to the severe recession. The recession, after all, was simply caused by government-ordered lockdowns to flatten the infection curve, bringing a sudden stop to a large share of the global economy. So in principle, reopening after the lockdown in the next 6 to 8 weeks in many jurisdictions should result in a sharp bounce, much like we experienced after most past recessions, rather than the L-shaped slower recovery. However, this outlook is highly uncertain, and it depends strongly on how the pandemic is going to evolve in the next 18 months. And as we all know, there's many questions still remaining about COVID-19, including how does it spread, the seasonal patterns, and possible severity of secondary rounds of infection. Most importantly of all, we don't know when a medical solution will become widely available to most populations around the world. Now, naturally, a quick resolution to this health crisis would certainly support investors' optimism for a V-shaped recovery. But the risk is that the longer the medical uncertainties linger about how to treat COVID-19, the more likely that households and businesses will stay on the sidelines, delaying consumption and investment spending. The economic slowdown would then become more extended, threatening to transform a liquidity squeeze into a solvency problem, leading to more business failures, more prolonged unemployment, and a greater risk of a slow L-shaped recovery. Now, fortunately, we've seen very aggressive economic policies in major economies that have greatly reduced this tail risk of a broader financial crisis from the temporary cash crunch. Major central banks have slashed interest rates. They've established new lending facilities, and they've provided liquidity to ensure the smooth functioning of credit markets. In this way, central banks played a vital role as lenders of last resort, providing liquidity to markets and credit to businesses when many investors were hoarding cash and equivalents during the lockdown. Now, amazingly, issuance of U.S. investment-grade debt has actually surged this year by about $1 trillion U.S. in the first 5 months of 2020, despite the crisis. And that compares to just $540 billion in the same period last year, as companies are taking advantage of the lending facilities from the Fed to build up a war chest of cash in these uncertain times. So central banks have essentially also printed enormous amounts of money to purchase government bonds, monetizing the enormous increase in deficit finance pandemic relief. The Fed has purchased $1.6 trillion of U.S. Treasuries since March. And that compared to Treasury debt issuance of just $2.3 trillion, implying that the Fed is effectively printing money to finance a very large share of the government's budget deficit. Government budget deficits have also ballooned enormously to address the severe scale of this recession. The U.S. has already approved about $3 trillion, or over 13% of GDP, which is expected to raise the total U.S. budget deficit from just under 6% of GDP last year to an estimated 18% of GDP or more this year. And in Canada, the pandemic could increase the budget deficit by over $250 billion, or over 10% of GDP. Other major economies are also dramatically increasing their fiscal deficits, including the Eurozone, Japan, and China, all supporting the global recovery. So there's really no question that aggressive central bank and government policies have been enormous in size and very rapidly implemented, helping to replace lost incomes and preventing greater unemployment, and also supporting businesses during their temporary cash squeeze. But the key question for the future direction of the market is whether these policies will lead to stronger or weaker recoveries compared to what markets have effectively already priced in following a 35% rally from March 23rd. And some leading economic indicators today still remain relatively subdued, such as the flat yield curve compared to history, low levels of expected inflation based on 10-year TIPS, which are just slightly over 1%, and Canadian 10-year real return bonds, which are even lower. So given these mixed signals, our team's keeping a neutral position in our long-term asset mix between equities and government fixed income until we see stronger signs, confirmation effectively, that the V-shaped bounce is going to materialize. Our own team's economic outlook is broadly in line with the consensus forecast of a sharp recession this year followed by a sharp rebound next year. But we feel this scenario has already been largely priced in by markets. So we're keeping a close eye on monthly leading indicators like PMIs and our own big data indicators to look for confirmation of the rebound or signs that another scenario is taking shape instead. So that leaves us with our advice to investors at this stage, which is to stick to your long-term asset mix, rebalance regularly. And historically, this has helped investors recover more quickly after a sell-off. And if you do have a tactical view, we do recommend that these positions should be prudently sized in a portfolio, as a given tilt from your long-term asset mix carries higher risk today than compared to normal times. So let me just quickly conclude with some thoughts on portfolio construction, particularly in the context of long-term asset mix, given this climate of heightened uncertainty. Now, after this health crisis is firmly behind us, we face a large range of potential economic scenarios in the aftermath of today's very aggressive policies and the economic lockdown. And as we know, asset prices for stocks and bonds respond in typically predictable ways to how inflation and economic growth turn out relative to expectations. And we tend to categorize these possible scenarios into four broad or general types, each with different implications for future investment returns. I think of them generally as scenarios with higher or lower economic growth and higher or lower inflation than what's currently expected. And I think you can think of these four scenarios as one of four well-known types of economic regimes. There's first stagnation with prolonged weak growth, low inflation, and low interest rates. Stagflation with weak growth, high inflation, and high interest rates. Reflation with growth returning to its long-run trend and inflation running above central banks' 2% targets. And finally, we have the V-shaped recovery with subdued inflation below the 2% central bank target, which is largely what's priced in today, I think. Reflation and the V-shaped recovery are generally good news for equities, while stagnation and stagflation are generally bad news for stocks. Now, the problem is that equity risk drives most of your total fund risk and expected returns in most typical individual portfolios. And in these four scenarios that I've described, really only two out of four of them are positive scenarios for equities. So most investors are, in fact, quite sensitive to stagnation and stagflation risk. So a natural question is, well, how likely are these scenarios in the medium term? And I would say higher inflation could, of course, materialize once the global economy has recovered following the pandemic. And there's a number of factors why. On the demand side, inflation risk from unprecedented monetary and fiscal policy easing could push demand faster than supply, putting upward pressure on prices. On the supply side, reshoring of production may start to unwind global supply chains that have historically kept costs and prices low. Now, while stagflation-type scenarios like the 1970s energy crisis don't occur very often, when they do occur, they tend to be very painful for investors. So inflation-sensitive investors may wish to look for alternative-type asset classes like commodities, gold, and inflation-linked bonds to help hedge some of their portfolio inflation risk. Now, that's just one scenario. There are others. At the other extreme, you have disinflationary pressures, which some economists are still expecting. After all, we are in the most severe economic contraction since the 1930s. And if we do end up seeing a more protracted economic slowdown than currently expected, that would put downward pressure on equities as well, but would have less of an inflationary risk. So given this broad range of possible future scenarios, our view and our team's view is that investors should aim for balanced risk exposures so that portfolios are more resilient to the different possible future economic scenarios. Alternative investment strategies and alternative asset classes, especially those offering lower correlation to traditional equity and bond returns, are especially valuable in that context. The key point is to find strategies with low correlation to the traditional drivers of risk and return in your portfolio. So let me stop there and turn it back to Mike. Thank you very much.
Great, Todd. Thank you. Thank you very much. A very comprehensive overview. Love the structure and the framework for various outcomes and your strong advice on, you know, sticking to your knitting, focusing on your long-term asset allocation blend and really rebalancing as frequently as you need to bring those back into line, which I think sets up nicely the next component of our conversation with Benoit Ono. Gentlemen, welcome. We've had you on the call before and on the webcast, and I think you've done a great job in helping people understand the role that resources and commodities can play, particularly gold in client portfolios. And there's been a nice turn of events. I was just reviewing portfolio performance while Todd was speaking and looking at the stark recovery we've been seeing in the resource fund as well. So why don't I turn it over to Benoit first to take us through the case for gold and how that links to Todd's assessment of economic realities and the support provided by central banks, both here and around the world, and the impact that'll have on asset prices. So Benoit, why don't I turn it over to you?
Thank you, Mike. Hi to all of you. After I've heard speaking Todd here today, I guess it sets up nicely, as you say it, Mike, to talk about gold. And we've talked about gold in the past. And I think that in the previous conference calls we've had, we talked about gold as largely a response, immediate response, perhaps a refuge in some way, partly at least in some way, as we were reaching into the depth of COVID-19. And today, I guess we all passed that trough. I think the equity markets are probably the best guess today as to where society is headed. So what is clear, though, today is that there is a game strategy that is being employed by governments and central banks around the world, and that strategy is very similar. It is to make sure that there's ample money into the system and that money is deployed by the central banks, intervening and largely in the bond market, be it in the investment-grade bonds or sovereign bonds, but also governments intervening by sheltering society through this rough patch here that looks, well, it's already almost 3 months into this rough patch and is likely to linger as we're recovering into the third quarter. And so far, staples, utilities, stay-at-home stocks, if you want, were doing best. And it was easy to understand as the world was looking for a refuge. We're looking for businesses that are likely to be resilient, if not improved. Think of Amazon and Netflix as they were benefiting, if anything, from the stay-at-home strategies before we could think about recovery into the future. And gold, as we had positioned it in the past calls, was a response to more money coming. As we labeled it, more money is coming everywhere. And that is something that will likely to endure in the next several quarters. We were already in deficits in many places. More money was already coming everywhere before this crisis, and more so today as this crisis precipitated a need for even more money. So assets, however, whether it's goods, services, companies, real estate, assets are not in higher supply. Demand has faltered, but the supply hasn't changed. And in fact, supply has likely shrunk in many cases when it comes to goods and services. Think of beef supply for this summer. There will be less beef this summer. Real estate has probably seen supply come down. So this money is flushing around and looking for places, and gold is likely to be a barometer going forward for asset prices as the money is being put to work. So many people are fearing a prolonged recession and maybe are stashing some of that money on the side. If you're wealthy enough and feeling that this cushion is large enough, perhaps you've put some money timely into this market. And we suspect that prices are heading higher. And I think in a way that this is represented is the PE in the stock market is going higher. Here in Toronto, house prices are not coming down. And that's a big difference versus previous recessions when the governments were either absent or slow to respond to a recession. Yesterday's and the days before's events that we've seen are, as Todd was describing, a consequence of income inequality, and then for sure governments, whether it's in China talking about social pressure or here in America talking about racial issues, the governments, especially going into a presidential race, are likely to be very responsive. So we think that this recession is likely to be fairly straightforward, and I don't mean quick or fast. I mean in that we will likely see a typical sequence where the markets move slowly out of the safe or bond-like stocks into higher risk or higher cyclicality types of sector, whether it is banks or home builders or mid-caps or resources. Demand takes hold. Supply has been shrinking. So we're likely to see, as we're watching, perhaps if you're watching this on the internet, you can look at the mobility measures produced by Apple's and others. You can see people starting to travel to book restaurants. And at the moment, it's simply a volume game, and most companies are still not making profits at the restaurants, obviously. Same thing for resources. It's a volume at the moment recovery, and prices will follow right behind. So we position gold not only just as a refuge value, but also as a measure of real assets and to be used on portfolio where perhaps you have maxed out on your exposure to equities, and now you still want to protect from purchasing power devaluation over time. You can use gold as a replacement to the tune of 5 to 10% gold or gold stocks. And when it comes to resources, I think I'm going to turn it over to Ono here to talk about the execution, but it's about first overweighting, and we'll talk about some of the subsectors that have managed their supply better than others, or demand has been great or holding up, and that will produce a better return. But it will follow the typical sequence where we'll see higher demand, better prices into Q3 and Q4 and give you pretty attractive return. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ono here to talk about the execution.
Yeah, thank you, Benoit. And in the global resources portfolio, we're trying to offer to you that exposure to real assets and exposure to the economy. And with the amount of stimulus being provided, as mentioned by both speakers, the outlook for that economic recovery is, of course, a lot better today than what it looked at the depth of the crisis, because the amount of stimulus so far seems to be such that actually incomes have not come down during the crisis because of the government substituting those incomes. So to provide you with that exposure, we essentially break the portfolio into three main thematics and allocations. First of all, gold and gold equities. As Benoit has said, money supply is massive right now. That money will go somewhere. We believe gold will reflect that. We execute that by both an exposure to gold bullion and an exposure to gold equities. With the bullion providing lower volatility, and let it be said, the one feedback we've heard from all of you over the past decade is that the resources portfolio, is too volatile. And we're managing that volatility much tighter these days. And gold bullion plays an important role in any portfolio in reducing the volatility because gold has typically a negative or zero correlation with the broad markets. The gold equities have some exposure to the equity markets, but on the other hand, they have exposure to gold bullion, of course, and they offer the attraction of value creation through drilling and through discovery and development of new gold deposits. And the gold equities screen actually quite well on a relative valuation in the global universe right now. And therefore, gold has an important overweight position in the portfolio the past few months. And as we said, now that the immediate crisis is behind us, that will probably be worked down towards more of a market weight position in gold. The other important aspect of the resource portfolio is supply-demand fundamentals and how those have evolved over the crisis. And first and foremost, oil has not fared well, as we all know, both from a price behavior, but also from a speed of supply response to the demand collapse. We started off, of course, with Saudi Arabia and Russia going for a market share war, and actually glutting the oil market. And we've seen a slowish response elsewhere in the world to the low pricing. It takes time to shut down an oil well. So while oil prices have recovered to now to $35-$40, there might be some upside to that, but we believe at that point in time the oil price could be capped because there's simply a large inventory that needs to be worked down. And the inventory overshoot has been quite substantial. So within energy, we're much more attracted to exposure to gas, natural gas, and to the refiners. Exposure to natural gas is because gas did not get oversupplied. Demand was there. Whereas the supply of gas is closely tied, especially in North America, to the supply of oil, which is now being shut in. So as oil wells shut in, the gas supply comes down as well, whereas the demand is fairly inelastic for gas. So we have substantial positions in ARC, Tourmaline, etc., to the exposure to the natural gas. Within oil, we're attracted to the refiners, because if the world still has a lot of oil in inventory, but the demand is coming back for gasoline in particular, you can see in Europe and especially in China that miles driven is actually now already flat to up relative to prior to the crisis, as people avoid public transport and take the car to get around. So strong gasoline demand, but with still substantial oil supplies available, should play into the margins of the oil refiners. On the supply and demand fundamentals for other commodities, such as lumber, we saw very rapid response to reduce demand, so there hasn't been an inventory overshoot. And the same for iron ore and for copper and for fertilizers. So those are some of the subsectors where we believe a price recovery can be faster because there is at least not the big inventory overhang that we see in the oil right now. Then lastly is the thematic positioning of the portfolio. And we've already in the past tilted the portfolio more towards the green economy and to sectors where we should see structural demand trends outperforming. But I think you can add to that the thematic now of job creation, low interest rates, and ample stimulus. The three thematics there are, for example, infrastructure, where we believe governments will focus some of the stimulus because you can direct it as a government and you can deploy a lot of people in doing it, and it benefits the economy in the long run. So infrastructure investments could go up. They're already going up, of course, in China, and Europe and the U.S. could follow, which would be very beneficial for steel, iron ore, copper, lumber, etc. Low interest rates have a beneficial effect on housing. Yes, we acknowledge that the consumer is not all good in the world, but if you look at U.S. housing formation, low interest rates are a very important driver, and we anticipate, as Todd mentioned, low interest rates to be sustained for a long time. On top of that, repairs and remodeling of existing housing stock is currently seeing a massive upswing. I guess we've all been busy in our backyards fixing up that shed that needed to be fixed for the past 15 years, with beneficial effects on lumber and then paint. So those are two of the other thematics where we're well represented in the portfolio. Lastly, in Europe, you can see, for example, the stimulus now also merging into somewhat of a green deal, where the authorities use their stimulus to direct the environmental agenda. And that could play in the hands of electric vehicles, copper, or the renewal of the electrical power infrastructure. So those are the thematic overlays on the portfolio, which of course is always grounded first and foremost in the valuation call and in the supply-demand fundamentals for each commodity. So with that, Mike, over to you.
Great, Benoit Ono, thank you very much for your comments. Appreciate that. Emily, why don't we canvas the lines and see if we have any questions. We get them in several different ways. Sometimes I get texts and emails, and I've got a number online here.
Thank you. We will now be taking questions from the telephone lines. If you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before making your selection. Please press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you would like to ask a question. There will be a brief pause while the participants register. We thank you for your patience.
So, Ono, while we wait for questions to come in over the line, I was intrigued by your comment about tilting the resource portfolio towards the green economy. Can you expand further on that? Very unusual to hear the resource guy talk about sort of the green economy.
Yes, thank you, Mike. We actually wrote two white papers on this before the white paper with regards to money supply, which really played into the long-term thesis for gold, as you mentioned. But before that, we already, of course, started to embrace the reality what society wants. And society obviously wants a greener future. And that will, in our view, result in certain commodities gradually starting to trade at a discount, and certain commodities over time starting to trade at a premium. And whether that's a price premium or a price discount or a demand acceleration versus a demand moderation. And it's obviously very clear that oil demand will moderate over time. But let's say be specific, oil demand will still grow with the world economy, but that rate of growth is likely to start to moderate somewhat in favor of electrons, electrification of society. And those thematics were already embedded in the portfolio. I'm just pointing out now to say, well, if you are a government and you have a trillion here or there to spend to get the economy back onto the rails, where would you spend it? You would spend it towards jobs, and you would spend it towards meeting the other societal goals, which is definitely the green society. So the key thematics in our portfolio are gas over oil. Gas is much cleaner than oil and is a transition commodity for the next 10 to 20 years as we try to migrate the power grid to all renewable. But there's still a need to stabilize the grid, and gas can do that a lot cleaner than coal or oil in particular. The other one is lumber over plastic, and lumber being fiber sources for packaging. So think paper packaging or advanced paper/plastic packaging as a preference over plastic. It means copper over steel in the long run, more electricity, less bulk building. So those are some of the thematics that already are in the portfolio, and I think the stimulus will only accelerate some of those trends.
Interesting. Excellent. Thank you for sharing that. Emily, who do we have on the line?
Thank you. Once again, please press *1 on your telephone keypad if you would like to ask a question. We have a question from Kim Leo. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hello?
Hey, Kim, over to you. Kim, you're live. Go ahead. Ask your question. Kim, can you hear us?
Kim, if your line is muted, please unmute your line.
Kim, I think we can hear you. We'll give you one more chance. Oh, I'm afraid you're going to have to move on, Emily.
Once again, please press *1 if you would like to ask a question. We have no
Benoit
questions registered at this time.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. So, Benoit, I did get an email over the app previously regarding gold and the outlook for gold's performance in a deflationary environment. Could you care to expand on, I think the thesis around your more money is coming your way white paper was driving asset prices up. What about a deflationary environment? And then we could perhaps have Todd give his thoughts on inflation, deflation as well.
Yeah, and I don't think we're setting up for the classical either inflation or deflationary environment. I think in the past, when we had deflation, you had a lack of intervention by governments and central banks. And before the creation of central banks, you had deflation when you had a tremendous loss of demand. And you can think of a pandemic, which would be the analogy, a perfect analogy today. that would reduce your population by a large amount, like 20% or something. So it's a plague of some sort. But what we know is that every time we had an event where demand was greatly affected, the question was always about time. So if you have a deflation first, then all asset prices come down, and the only winning asset class is cash and maybe some bonds. But even then, it better be the right bond, because when you have deflation, what happens is that all asset coverage comes down. So if you have the asset's value come down tremendously and the debt stays the same, that's not the kind of environment the market likes. And eventually the central banks intervenes or the government intervenes, and that's when a lot of money comes your way. And eventually all assets reflate, some others faster than others. But what we know also is that when you do get deflationary environment, the response is even larger. And I think we had this episode in 2011 and 8 when the Europeans were late in responding to the crisis. They had to add even more money eventually in 2011. And all asset prices, including gold, go higher. Well, I mean real asset prices. So stocks, real estate, gold, and others.
Todd, any comments specific to inflation, deflation in your forecasts and the models you work with?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And I agree with what Benoit was saying. They use the framework I was describing earlier. There's really four scenarios. And when you think of inflation coming in lower than expected, so that could be something like an outright deflation or even strong disinflationary pressures, that's typically not a great environment for gold or other kind of inflation-sensitive assets. But there's other scenarios, of course, when gold outperforms. That might be when inflation comes in higher than expected, sort of in a reflation or possibly even in stagflationary environments. So it really comes down to, I think, there's a tactical view and a sort of strategic asset allocation view. Tactically, if you believe in a certain type of regime is going to dominate the future outlook, you may want to hold those assets that you expect to outperform in that environment. So if you believe in a high inflation environment or higher than expected inflation environment, then gold and other commodities look attractive. If you believe that we're going to face a prolonged period of stagnation, lower than expected growth, lower than expected inflation, then, you know, you would probably underweight. But that's a tactical view. And in my mind, you really want to be humble about that because it's very hard to forecast. So building in sort of insurance into your long-term asset mix by having exposure to a broad range of asset classes, including alternative asset classes, is helpful because it makes your portfolio more resilient over a full cycle and over different types of regimes. So that's sort of how we think about it.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it. Benoit Ono, another comment came in over the web here. When stocks went down recently, gold and precious metals mining companies went down with them. What's the best way to position gold in your portfolios? Is it bullion? Or is it the actual producers?
I'll take that, Mike. They both have a different role, bullion and the gold equities. Bullion is your pure expression of a alternative currency that cannot be printed. And bullion has typically low volatility. We always keep on staring at the screen and say, gold is up or down $10, that's a big move. But in percentage terms, it's of course a very small move. So the implied volatility of bullion is much lower, and bullion is your ultimate liquid asset class, even in a crisis. So when the crisis hit, bullion got hit a little bit because it was available and it was liquid, but it's a very deep market. Gold equities, on the other hand, of course, reflect the price of bullion, but they're also equities still. So when the margin clerks move in and equity portfolios have to be liquidated, gold equities get taken to the cleaner with the broad market on a very short time frame. following that initial liquidation moment, you saw it in 08, and again, we saw it here in 2020, gold equities quickly regained their footing, and typically are the first ones to regain their footing, coming out of a liquidity event, because they reflect the gold price, and the pressure of immediate liquidation goes away. So with the equities, you get higher volatility than you get with bullion. The fraction of the equities, on the other hand, is they have a leverage to bullion of roughly 2-to-1 in the long run. So they give you more levered exposure to bullion. If you're positive on bullion, you want to emphasize that with equity exposure. And equities can pay a dividend and can create value over time by discovery and development. So our neutral position is always 50% bullion, 50% equities, as part of that 5 to 10% allocation of any portfolio towards the gold space in general as part of insurance. And in bullish periods for gold, and I would say we're still in that period because real interest rates are still heavily negative, which historically has led you to a 17% per year appreciation in gold, then you can tilt it slightly more towards the equities in favor of bullion. But first and foremost, look what the client's risk profile is, and bullion is less volatile than the equity.
Thanks, Ono. Appreciate that. At the outset, I commented on the strong rebound we've seen in the resource, the Global Resource Fund. Care to make any comments on attributes? Clearly, there's a heavy weighting to energy. We've seen a big recovery in oil and energy prices. Quarter to date, I think the as of yesterday's close, Global Resource Fund is up 35.75%, which is impressive, but pales in comparison to the Precious Metals Fund, which is quarter to date up 51%. So we've seen some handsome moves from both the portfolios the two of you manage. Any comments on that?
Yeah, I think that we are going to go back to this idea of having a sequential economic recovery where stocks that have earnings going higher got repriced faster, and failing that, the stocks where earnings didn't go anywhere, the utilities or the likes, right, or a bond where the income hasn't changed really. And I think we, when you think of that sequence, you can think of resource of being certainly past the halfway point with gold somewhere as a general barometer of hard assets. So think of it as a general market stocks where more money is coming. We got the benefit first, i.e. a better performance, certainly. And we have gold in the portfolio to the tune of one-third over that period. And then the remaining two-thirds, depending on how we position the chips here during that period, also got to benefit. But I think we think that demand is coming back very gradually into this recovery. So we think the tailwinds for demand are good, and the price are likely to get better if supply has been managed. So commodities where the supply is being managed are already showing signs of a recovery. So closer to home, you can think of the house building industry where people can't wait to go back to work because there's large amounts of pent-up demand for houses in the U.S. particularly, and there hasn't been really a build-up of inventory in lumber because prices were already tough. There was no money in lumber. And now we took out a bunch of inventory at the Home Depot, at the lumber mills, and prices are recovering quite quickly, and so are the stocks.
Excellent. Probably not a bad place to leave it right there. We're coming up on the top of the hour. So, gentlemen, Todd, Benoit, Ono, I want to thank you for your insights today and your guidance and expertise on the portfolios you run. We at McKinsey recognize the importance of staying connected, and that's exactly what calls like this one are designed to do. And we know that we truly are better together. As part of staying connected, we urge you to reach out to your McKinsey sales team and or visit the McKinsey website and access commentary on calls we've run like this and the various webcasts and additional resources we have set up on Corona under the COVID-19 landing page. Be sure to join us on our continuing webcast series this Thursday at 4 p.m. We have Phil Taller and Sunny Agarwal from the Mackenzie Growth Team joining us, so please join us for that. And in truth, these are indeed extraordinary times. And we know as we slowly emerge from self-isolation and the economy takes careful steps back towards a new normal, we at Mackenzie will be here to support you and your clients every step of the way. In the meantime, we wish you and your families a safe and healthy future, and be well, everyone, until we see you again.